Welcome to the newest episode of the Little House Book Club. The Little House Book Club is family-friendly and listener-supported, which means no commercials. If you would like to share your thoughts or suggest a book or author, please email me at mark@walnutgrovecast.com. Today, I have a very special guest. Her name is Wendy McClure. She is an author, and she's written quite a number of books, but the book that really got my interest was The Wilder Life, My Adventures in the Lost World of Little House on the Prairie. Welcome to the show, Wendy. How are you doing?
I'm good, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. And, you know, I really enjoyed the style that your book is written in. It's, you know, as somebody who's not written a book, I always wonder if it's a good thing to say what I'm about to say, but I think it's a good thing. I feel like I can open up your book almost anywhere and start reading it. I feel like I don't have to read it straight through.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like some books are really kind of constructed to have a linear feel. And while yours does follow a certain method, you know, it really can be written completely through, probably makes the most sense. I find that I could just kind of open it up and find something that interests me. And I enjoy it.
Oh, thank you. You know, I think it's funny because I think like a lot of people sort of say that, you know, once you've read the Little House book straight through, I think a lot of people, you know, when I talk to people about rereading the, you know, the Little House series, mm-hmm. that it's that same kind of experience that you might just sort of grab a book and open it anywhere and you start reading. And that's certainly been my experience, you know, sure. especially because, you know, in the course of writing this book and in the years after, you know, lots of times I have to, you know, sort of being in this little house community, you know, you grab a book to look something up and then you sort of find yourself just kind of caught up in the story again. So if in some way, you know, my book kind of did that same thing, that's really cool. Thank you.
You know, I tend to read everything in the Hebrew way. Like I'll start in the back and go backwards. And it's just, I don't know. It's just always been the way I kind of am. It gives me a good feel for the book too. So have you always had a love of Laura Ingalls Wilder and Little House on the Prairie?
Yes. Well, sort of. You know, I read the books when I was a kid, but there was actually sort of there was a long break between when I last read the books and when I read them again. I don't know, long about 2008 or so. And during that time, I always sort of remembered that I loved the books, mm-hmm. but I was kind of afraid to go back to them. I think part of this is because of my job as a children's book editor and looking at children's books critically. And I think I was sort of afraid to go back.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I was afraid to go back to these sort of really, you know, these beloved books with kind of like my editor's eye. And also because, you know, over the years, you read, so much historical fiction when, at the sort of middle grade level. And a lot of it is not good.
Yeah, it doesn't age well, right? I mean, it's almost like we age out of it and we kind of, I know that this has happened to me where I'll go back and I just think, what am I thinking? Like I didn't, how, it's unreadable or even the movies are like that. You know, I just think I wasted so much time watching this.
A lot of it is really purposeful. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of it is, the Little House books are purposeful. I do remember like learning so much about, sure. you know, how things were made and how things were done. And so it is kind of a trope of historical children's literature to, you know, do a lot of explaining about, you know, what things are and things, but, you know, I saw a lot of it being done badly. So, you know, it was just, you know, every sort of description was just sort of bogged down and, you know, and there was just a lot of, you know, I don't know, just like, you know, like fetch the musket and, you know.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
It was also very foreign to me especially. I mean, I'm sure maybe to you as well.
Yeah.
You know, the whole concept of making the bullets and things like that, things like I just I wasn't around anything like
that. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I, you know, so knowing that, and I think I remember even I was working for a textbook company, sort of early on in my publishing career, and, you know, came across the passage where they are, from Little House in the Big Woods, where Laura and Mary are batting around the pig splatter.
Yeah.
And I saw that in a whole new way too. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, they're hitting around pig guts.
It's a real pig skin.
You know, yeah. And I remember when I was a kid, I had sort of no idea that that was, you know, that was like actually like, you know, like a, like an internal organ they were batting. I just thought it was sort of like the balloon, like, you know, oh, there's a balloon inside a pig. It's like a cereal box prize, you know? And
it was great like, fun. That's fun. I remember in the book, it was great fun after the slaughtering.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and I was like, oh, wow. And I sort of saw that in a new way, but I was a little, you know, I was a little freaked out, honestly. So I think things like that, I'm like, oh gosh, I'm going to be reading all these things and, you know, in like a new light, and it's going to be kind of horrifying.
Did it hold then, up?
Yeah. But then when I finally went back to the books, and the thing is to know too, is that I never had like lots of other people who grew up with a set of the books that they just, you know, moved with them and you know, they always just kept with them. And I always got my books from the library. So I never had my own collection that I would go back to. So when I, you know, last time I read the books in, I don't know, 1980 something, then, you know, I didn't pick them up again. And so then it took me discovering an old copy of Little House in the Big Woods that turns out we did have, that turned up at my parents' garage sale, and then reading that and then realizing, oh my gosh, these are great.
We can't this sell this, great, right?
Yeah, this is a great story. Yeah. And then my now husband, but then boyfriend, found a blue paperback box set of the paperbacks at like a local thrift store. And he brought them home and he said, you know, you mentioned you liked rereading Little House in the Big Woods. Maybe you want to read the whole thing. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to get to all those, but thank you. That's nice. But then one after another, that whole summer, I just started.
It called to you on a rainy day, right?
Yes. Yes. And that summer I went around constantly with a Little House paperback in my purse.
You know, when I love going to like secondhand shops, you know, like these you know, Goodwills and stuff like that. That's always fun to like look for stuff, especially through the books. And I'll always find a Laura Ingalls Wilder book. Like always. Yeah. And I don't know, I always grab it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I must have so many different copies of just multitudes of copies. And yeah, I tell everyone, you know, it's like there's really no excuse. I mean, you just go to any thrift shop, you'll probably find a copy for a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's such a fun, easy read.
Yeah.
And it's so simple. And I don't know. I suggest everybody really just snatch one up and read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on the topic of the book itself, which is, you know, about Little House on the Prairie, of course, but it's also a lot about you as a person and, you know, as you're growing and you're growing with Little House on the Prairie, when did you decide on the topic here? Because this is a pretty complex topic. I'm curious if this is something that started when you were little, in a way.
Oh, you mean
the wilder life, the whole concept.
Yeah, yeah. Really, it came from this experience that I just told you about of going back and rereading the mm-hmm. books and having, you know, suddenly, you know, coming back and sort of seeing this world that I'd loved as a kid mm-hmm. and sort of seeing it as an adult and also realizing for the first time that I could actually go there. Yeah, because, you know, as a kid, the world of the books seemed, I knew it was real. And it was also sort of, it reminded me of the world I knew, especially because my parents liked to go camping. And so, you know, and we actually did go on these long road trips through, we drove to New Mexico one time. And so we were driving through Kansas. And I remember even, you know, sort of like looking out, you know, the car window at the fields of Kansas and sort of wondering if I would see the little house in the prairie, you know, log cabin off in the distance somewhere.
Sure.
And, you know, we went camping in Wisconsin, and I grew up in the Chicago area. So in Illinois, so we did a lot of camping also in rural Illinois. And so, you know, but it never occurred to me to like ask my parents if we could ever go to these places. I kind of always hoped that we would just pass by one of these places.
Well, as a kid, you think you will, right? I mean, we think we're going to pass everything at some point.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, so then, you know, going back and seeing like, oh yeah. Okay. So where in Wisconsin was she born? Pepin, Wisconsin. Okay. Where is that? So I started just looking things up on the map and also realized that there were these museums and these home sites that you could go to, and thinking, I'm an adult with a car and disposable income. This is something I could do that would be really fun. And just the idea of doing that was just sort of like, oh my gosh, this is like suddenly like, it's like kind of like realizing that you can go to Narnia or something.
In your book, you do document a lot of the journeys and how you would get there and something wouldn't be to your exact liking, like you expected. I believe it was the sod house to be.
Oh, yeah.
Like you had read about this thing and you had this vision in your head. It wasn't quite exactly what you wanted.
And well,
nothing ever is, though. You know, it's.
Well, what really got me was just, you know, seeing how small it was.
Right.
And so, yeah, there was definitely a lot of that kind of adjustment, sort of seeing, you know, like when you read By the Shores of Silver Lake and you read about the surveyor's house, mm-hmm. You know, in my mind, that house sounded huge because it had upstairs and it had a whole other pantry and it had, you know, it had all these sort of different rooms. I mean, if you're sort of keeping track and actually sort of keeping track of how many rooms there actually were, you could probably figure out it was pretty small, but, you know, but in relative terms, it seemed, you know, really big. So it was, you know, kind of amazing to see that how, when you actually go to South Dakota, and you go to DeSmet and you see it, it's like, it's a pretty small house. So there was that kind of adjustment. At the same time, like the landscapes and everything were, you know, just as I imagined them. So that was kind of surprising too. And that actually, I expected some things to be different and I would definitely sort of react to, you know, things but sometimes, there were lots of times when, you know, it was sort of everything I thought it would be.
One of the things that stood out to me is in the first book, in Little House in the Big Woods, there's a moment where, well, there's a couple moments where Laura's really kind of down on her looks. You know, she's always, I think she's being compared to Mary very often, or she's comparing herself to Mary and she's always putting down her brown hair and things like that. And you mentioned how it kind of helped you accept your own brown hair, which, of course, is the same color as Pa's.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That really resonated with me. I have blackish brown hair, and I never really thought – I've always been fine with it. But, as you know, a girl might have a different, you know, outlook on this, the whole – like, I guess we'll go down a rabbit hole of the beauty myth or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's – it just really resonated with me in the book when they go to the town and the shopkeeper is more, you know, eyeing Mary in a creepy way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, stay away from that girl. And it's just, I don't know, there was something about it. I just thought it was really kind of nice and sweet and for you to kind of even make that connection and, you know, accept your own appearance and make that, you know, I just thought it was sweet. And it's something that I just remembered separately. So I thought that was interesting. And I thought it was the whole thing was an interesting take on it.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my hang up as a kid was I had my hair kind of cut kind of short. And because actually my hair has grown up really long now because of the pandemic. And actually I can see now why my mom kept it short because it's a mess.
It's good to go both ways. It's fine. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. But, but it was sort of cut short like a boy. And I remember being kind of upset about it and, you know, and I had my older brother and so sometimes, you know, they might, you know, mistake us. Oh, well, you know, what we were boys have. I'm like, no, I'm a girl. all, you know. And then also, you know, I began to gravitate towards like really long dresses and, you know, things like, you know, that signified femininity as, sure. as much as possible. And so I think I did, in that way I sort of identified with, you know, with young Laura as mm-hmm. As not having something like, you know, like these golden curls that Mary had. I sort of recognized that like I don't have something that other girls have, and I feel weird about that. And, you know, yeah, I thought that was really, you know, on a primal level. And those first couple of books do just such a good job of really sort of, you know, evoking that really early childhood experience.
Yeah, it really makes you feel young again. Like, I don't know. I think I'll read it. And, you know, as a boy, of course, I'm reading it very differently. Because yeah. I read it when I was in third grade. Mm-hmm. And it really takes me back to being in the third grade, which is crazy to me, because it's 150 years ago. For me, anyway. And another thing I really love that you were talking about is that, in your opinion, and it's not just an opinion, I think that you point out a lot of things, is that Laura is not a tomboy, just that she's really tomboyish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, well, it's interesting because, I mean, I did a lot of thinking about this while working on the book and working in sort of this chapter of sort of like having kind of like, you know, what's girlhood in the Little House books. Mm. And for a lot of the books, you know, those childhood stories of hers, there's not really much in the way of boys to compare herself to. And so there was sort of never a sense that she really wanted to be a boy, except sometimes when, you know, she, maybe in like, you know, playing, I don't know, I can't remember what book, and, you know, playing some games and stuff. But I liked the sense of that she got to be sort of wild and got to climb on things and got to get dirty, but she still also got to have the braids and the long dresses. So there was something like that combination that was just like super cool to me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the idea of her being a tomboy, that didn't make sense to me, because it was sort of like, well, it's not like she, you know,
compared tried to what, to,
like,
right?
It's yeah. Right. You know, have short hair or something like that. I mean, something like, you know, this is also something that I'm also willing, you know, if someone says like, no, I think I identify as a tomboy and identify with Laura, like, I'll take that too, you know? But you know, in my experience, it was sort of, I like that she was like rough and tumble, but also still very much a girl.
Yeah. And I think girls from this period of time probably had to be a little more rough and tumble than girls who kind of grew up a little bit more prissy, you know, these days. Not that all girls grow up prissy.
Are you talking about 70s girls or 1870s?
Yeah, I'm thinking
girls.
Like 70s girls. Like kids, oh, yeah. You know, girls who grew, the girls I grew up with.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the girls you grew up with. You know, ones that didn't need to have real chores, you know, same thing with boys, you know, I mean, I don't think my son could really scrap with a kid from the 19th century, kick his butt, you know, like, you know, these boys or girls, they were just tougher, I would imagine. And Laura maybe was a little bit more rough and tumble, but yeah, you're right. There's not very many young boys. I mean, there's a couple here and there. We have cousins, but We don't get a complete comparison.
Yeah.
And when there are boys, I don't know. I don't think that she's on that same level as a boy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not really as a level, but the same, not considered boyish.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Another thing that you did in your book, that I really loved was you talked about your journey of, learning to churn butter with a churn. And I wanted to know if you could talk a bit about that. Stuff like this, it's so simple, right? You think it's so simple. We've seen it on the TV show. We've read about it in the books. And it's something that I bet you 95% of the people listening to us right now have never done. Me included.
Right. Yeah, churned butter. Well, it's funny because I went down a long deep rabbit
it's
hole.
It's cute,
about,
though. It's really, I love it. It's endearing, and it makes me want to churn butter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, you know, first of all, trying to find a Crock & Dash butter churn, one that actually worked, was a little hard looking on eBay, you know, because you could, you know, you could just, you could enter in butter churn on eBay and then you get those things with the, those jars with the crank paddle kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, fun aside, Laura Ingalls Wilder herself, was given one of those newfangled butter churns. These are the ones where it's the jar with the, with like the crank and the paddle and stuff.
Yeah.
And, she wrote a column about this when she was much older. It was one of her Missouri Ruralist columns, and she hated it. She thought, like, she just wanted to go back to her old, you know, crock and dash churn
or something. I don't even understand how they work. That's how bad it is. But I really wish I should know.
All it is taking cream, and then you're agitating it enough to, I think it's called like a reverse emulsification effect. Mm-hmm. And, so the, you know, with the crock and dash churn, it's funny that like right behind me in the front hall, I'm sitting here in the dining room, the butter churn is now, the crock of it is used to hold umbrellas. And it's a very nice stoneware crock.
I bet you that's very nice though. That looks
nice. It is nice. And actually, I think I used it, I was trying to make rum topf, something where you like soak fruit in rum and you have to keep it in a crock for a long time. And so I used that crock.
You're talking to a winemaker and a beer maker as well.
Oh yeah. So it's, get yourself a butter churn.
I'm doing it. We go to Amish country all the time. So I have the opportunity to buy one. So next time I'll treat myself.
So I finally got my churn, and then there was a matter of finding the cream, and really you just get heavy whipping cream from the store. I think now so much has changed in sort of the kinds of different foods you can get since the time I wrote the book and actually now. I think now it is much easier for me to go out and find someone who will be willing to sell me like unpasteurized cream from, you know, that's just come from a cow, but
it's gotten a little bit easier, right?
But long about 2009, it was a little bit harder. So I just used whipping cream from the store. And I remember I thought I was going to have to give myself hours and hours.
That's the way
it sort of sounded like from the passage in Little House in the Big Woods that it took a long time because they would say, because the story said something like, "Ma churned for a while and then let Mary have a turn when she was tired." And then you realize that, you know, Ma is just humoring her.
Because we think Ma doesn't get tired, right?
That's the way we're thinking, right? But you're like, oh my gosh, if Ma gets tired, it must take hours. Exactly. And so then you're churning out that splashing and splashing and splashing and splashing. And then suddenly like the splashing, then it kind of stops, and then, you know, it stops for a while, and then you open it up, and then you have this whole crock full of like whipped cream. So that's disturbing. And then you sort of have to work through that. And then eventually you get this big hunk of butter. And actually the hard part is not in the churning, but it's in the taking the hunk of butter and rinsing it and kind of squeezing all the buttermilk out because it keeps better that way. And that's actually kind of tedious. And then everyone's, you know, once I had done it, everyone's like, "Oh, I bet that butter tasted so good. I bet it's, you know, like the most amazing butter ever." I'm like, actually, it just tastes like butter. It just tastes like the regular butter at the store, you know, like the process, you know. I'm sure if I got like, you know, something from like, you know, fancy cream from, you know, from a cow that had been, you know, fed on grass cow, and sang to every night and stuff like that, like then that would be really good butter. Like if the cream was really special, but when you're going with supermarket cream, then what you get tastes like supermarket butter.
It doesn't just turn into Kerrygold Swedish.
Right. I know. Yeah.
So Irish, it's just, butter. Sorry.
Yeah. Or fancy Amish stuff. It's still just, it's still butter. So it's still pretty good. But, after, you know, the book was out, I started, you know, when I was doing touring, I went around with a mason jar, and usually before my bookstore event, we would have to, you know, we'd be like in a different city somewhere. We'd have to sort of, you know, run somewhere to find, you know, to a 7-Eleven or something like that, where we could find some whipping cream, because we made it into sort of like an audience thing at my book events, where you would, because you don't need a crock and dash.
That's a great idea.
You can just take some whipping cream and pour it into a mason jar with a lid. I suggest actually getting one of the plastic lids that go with the mason jars, because they seal a lot better than temporarily. And then you just shake it up. And so what we would do is we'd pass this jar around of whipping cream, and people would, shake it up. And while I was reading or answering questions, and then at some point be like, okay, how's the butter doing? And, and some, okay, shake it a little bit more, and, so that was really fun. People really liked that. And it got so that my publicist would say, when they give you the schedules and stuff, for the bookstores you're going to visit, they always give you, the address, the bookseller you're supposed to talk to, the contact, what time you're supposed to be there, and then some notes. And then, so sometimes I would get notes like, they would like you to churn butter. So that was something I did.
It's a great visual.
The weird thing was, is that we hardly ever ate the butter. Sometimes people would bring, the bookseller would have crackers or something like that to spread it on, or pieces of bread if they were thoughtful. But I really hate to say this, but I actually wound up dumping lots of butter down hotel room toilets.
Well, what are you going to do with all this butter? It's like, you can only go with maybe one pat at a time.
I know. Yeah. Cause you would, a pint mason jar full of cream, that's actually about the size of a stick of butter or so.
But yeah, so walking around with a pound of butter. Why, what do you have in your hotel refrigerator?
So
So you talk about the tours that you were on. When you released this book, did you feel as though you were onto something? Because the book is very well received. And there are so many great things written about how people from all over the whole gamut of other authors and, people really, really resonated. The book really resonated with them. So many great things were written about the book. Did you foresee that? Did you think this is really something that I think people will really enjoy? I mean, obviously you have to like your own work enough to want to publish it, but I would imagine, did you foresee that at all?
I mean, I was sort of wondering, when you have a book idea in the first place, you have to get people excited about it enough to want to, for them to give you some money.
Sure. And it's the name of the game. Sure.
Yeah. And so, what had happened is that, I had this sort of idea about, wanting to go around and visit all these places. And so I think, I was just starting to tell people sort of casually, oh, it's great. I'm reading the Little House books. I really like them. Someday I would love to go around and visit all the home sites and write a book about it. Right. And so I would say that. And then a couple of friends of mine were like, you maybe should do that now, don't you think? I'm like, well, what's it? And then so looking around, and I think we'd just talking to people and being like, oh yeah, that's I love that. And, and then hearing, I think it was around the time Melissa Gilbert got her book deal for her autobiography. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, maybe there's something in the air a little bit. So there was a little bit of a sense of that. And I think it was also just sort of hearing people respond to, me talking about it, and also just sort of thinking maybe there was something maybe generational too. It was all these people who grew up in the 70s who were sort of looking back and were sort of raised on the books in a different way than previous generations, because there was the TV show and stuff like that. So that maybe it was sort of, it was kind of ripe for a look back at that.
The whole book, it's very sweet, but it's also just a real glimpse into you, which I think is really interesting, because you're very funny throughout the whole thing too. It's very much written in your voice, I would imagine. It's I don't know. It's not like there's a lot of your opinions here. Not all of them are going to be what other Little House fans are going to completely agree with. But but you just, you know, it's your opinion. That's that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's my book. You can't change it. You know, it's that type of thing. I love it.
Yeah.
You also talk about, you and I spoke last week and you brought up the TV show, The Young Pioneers.
Oh, yeah.
And you wrote a bit about that. And that's a show I've not had the opportunity to watch yet, but I did find on YouTube.
Oh, good.
But I
okay.
think the history behind it, and everybody here should just see if they can find a copy on YouTube. And it looks really interesting. I put it on for like 10 minutes and I'm like, all right, my head is not into it right now, but I have to revisit it.
Do you want me to talk a little bit about the story about?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love
that. So weird backstory as well is that, like, and you read this in the book, but I never really watched the TV show as a kid. And it was, and I figured out why going back and looking at old TV schedules. My parents just never tuned in because back in the 70s, you know, everyone watched the same thing as a family.
Did one and, TV. Most people had one TV.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think sort of similar to, you know, like us never going to any of the home sites, even though we were, you know, sort of within driving distance, you know, I don't think I ever, you know, said to my parents, like, hey, can we turn on Little House on the Prairie? I actually didn't know that Little House on the Prairie was the same Little House on the Prairie as the books, because I would see Michael Landon in commercials and that wasn't Pa.
Right. So, right. That other guy, you know. Sure.
So, and then the big discovery was that the show ran the same time slot as WKRP in Cincinnati, which was what my family watched.
Which is a great show. It was very fun.
Which is, it's an awesome show. It's an amazing show. And that's also worth like a rewatch, by the way.
With Lonnie Anderson, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Howard Hassman. Just so good. Mm-hmm. And so then later on, and then also, especially while I was working in the book, I sort of got into the TV show and I have a sort of a different relationship to the TV show that I think other people have. So it's not like childhood nostalgia. It's more more sort of like a pop culture appreciation for me, it's more, that show is more about the 70s to me than about the relationship to the books and stuff.
Yes. I mean, it definitely, it quickly goes another way.
So the story is that, there was Michael Landon, you know, working on the show, and then also, and then the producer, Ed Friendly, and, who, you know, this famous story is that he was reading his kid's copy, I think, of like Little House on the Prairie, like on a plane trip. And when his plane landed, you know, he was like, we have to do a TV show. You know, it's like, I have to get the rights, you know? And I just imagined him like getting off a plane and he's like, get me Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, I'm like, she's dead. Get me her people, you know? And
why would you, you know, it's like one of those type of.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
inspired moments.
So, you know, I guess what happened is that, you know, a few episodes into Little House on the Prairie, Michael Landon kind of takes over, kind of makes it his own thing and takes it in a different direction away from the books. And so, Ed Friendly, I think he was casting about for something else. So he comes across, or maybe had the rights to, I don't know, because I'm not sure how the literary estate works, whether the rights they got for Laura's stuff did it also like include
it's so
Rose's
confusing
stuff, you
know? It's so confusing,
like, yeah, so confusing it, so
and you know it's confusing and it's like you're from publishing, you know, you work in publishing, and I've worked in publishing, I still find it completely, I can't get a straight answer.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well yeah, yeah, there's we could do a whole episode on just like the different sort of weird sort of like lawsuits and and rights controversies and
it
things
is,
like that
odd.
But anyway, so what he found, you know, he realized that Rose Wilder Lane, Laura's daughter, who, had, you know, kind of a hand in writing the novels as well.
Of course, yeah.
But she also wrote her own pioneer novels, and they were written for adults and using the exact same material as Laura, you know, meaning like Laura's childhood and then the story of, you know, Charles and, you know, Caroline Ingalls. And so, so there are these books out there, including a book called Let the Hurricane Roar and a book called Freeland, which are about, you know, these pioneers going out, living in a sod house. There's a grasshopper plague. Then they have, you know, in another book, they're having a, you know, homestead claim in, you know, Dakota Territory, just like in the books. Mm-hmm. In the Little House books. So, so then what Ed Friendly did was decided to make a TV series based on these novels. And so, so it's a very,
this is about 76, right? 1976.
Yeah. Like right about 76. Mm-hmm. So it was called Young Pioneers and it only ran for like five episodes.
I mean, it's the bicentennial. It's a perfect time for something like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it was even the pilot, episode at least was even shot on the same, area in, I think, Arizona, where the Little House on the Prairie pilot was filmed. Mm-hmm. And not the same sets, but definitely like the same like land. And it's so different in tone from Little House on the Prairie. It's definitely the same, a lot of the same frontier hardships, but it's also like emphasis on the hardship. Mm-hmm. And so there's like childbirth scenes, and then there's the grasshopper plague scene, which was never in the Little House TV show, but it was definitely in the books and it was pretty gnarly. Yeah. And you know, and there's like getting caught in a blizzard and almost, you know, getting, you know,
it's brutal. It's a yeah, little bit really more brutal. Hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's these, you know, very telegenic, but still really stoic, you know, pioneer couple. And there's no, like, and it does have its light moments, but like Victor French is not going to come dancing in, you know, singing, you know, old Dan Tucker, you know.
It's a shame. It's what it needed.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely interesting in its own way. And so in some ways it's sort of, you know, like this is not your, you know, your fun, you know, family friendly, frontier show. This is harder. This is grittier,
From your perspective. So you didn't watch Little House on the Prairie when it aired on television. You really are just looking back as an adult at it. So you really put this short, series, The Young Pioneers right next to it. Really?
Well,
right?
No, I wouldn't put it next to it, but it's an interesting footnote. And I think anyone who is interested in both the books, and especially sort of like the historical content of the books, and the TV show, the Little House on the Prairie TV show, should try to find these on YouTube, especially now that I think, they're on YouTube now. And I think it's definitely kind of worth a look. It's an interesting artifact, I think.
And you go into all of this and more in your book. You go into so many different things. And one of the things, of course, we talked about that is pretty much the whole gamut of the book is visiting different historical locations.
Yeah.
Are there any locations that you were not able to get to? That you wanted to, anyway.
Oh, that I wanted to. well, actually, all of them I wanted count. To, actually. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there were some things like... I went to, Malone, New York, where the Farmer Boy, book.
That's the only one I went to, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really good site. And then, the site in Kansas, which was actually just sort of like half a day's drive from, Lauren L. Manzo's house in Mansfield, Missouri, yeah. Which is also a wonderful site, especially in terms of artifacts. And then the nice thing about, the Northern Midwest sites is that they are all fairly close to one another. Like if you go to Walnut Grove, it's not that much farther to go to DeSmet. Mm. So I was able to see those in one trip. And
it's gotta be fun to do it too in a car at 60 miles per hour. So,
oh, yeah.
You and, think to yourself, like, Laura would have been going at about 3 to 5 miles per hour.
know.
There's Pepin 15 minutes away, you know.
Well, yeah, we're even trying to get used to, I think we were staying in, where were we staying? In the town of Tracy, Minnesota. And the, so with, then we were driving to Walnut Grove, and that was the distance that they traveled on train in their first train trip. And it made it sound like it was like such a long train trip. And we're like, we drove this in like 20 minutes. that was really, again, like space and time and distance, in the Little House books, there's lots of adjustments, you know, that you make as a modern person looking back at the stuff. Yeah. So it was several different trips. The Minnesota, also Iowa, not in the books, but also an important site, because that was also another place where the Ingalls family stayed. So there were a couple of like extra credit sites where places where we knew, either the Ingalls family or Laura and Almanzo had lived, that weren't necessarily mentioned in the books. I haven't been down to Florida, where Laura and Almanzo lived for a short time around 1890, I think. So I'd like to see that. Mm-hmm. I think, let's see.
It's a short list.
Right? Yeah, it's a pretty short list. I mean, you know, most of the places where I haven't been are places where all that exists is maybe a sign. And you know, I am all for going, you know, someplace to see a sign. I have driven to see the sign that marks where Ma's birthplace is, you know, outside of Milwaukee, and you know.
But it's nice to experience that. I couldn't agree more. You know, I enjoy getting somewhere and being there.
Yeah.
You could just share in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of your books, I have to bring it up because I think I have to order this book. It just seems so amazingly fun. The Amazing Mackerel Pudding Plan.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this book, I just want to say, it touches upon the retro world of, I guess, strange food. And it focuses on the Weight Watchers recipe cards. And I just looked through some of, like, the shots of the book. And, like, it has those old kind of overexposed photos where it just looks, mm-hmm. the food just looks so bizarre. And where did this idea come from? Like, did you run into a bunch of these cards and just think somebody has to write something because it's crazy?
It's actually weird to think about, but like, you know, I've done like a lot of my books have come from ideas found in my parents' basement. that lone copy of Little House in the Big Woods, was unearthed. Yeah. It was, you know, turns out there had been a box of, you know, books that my parents had in their, you know, the crawl space of their house. And then when they had a garage sale, there it was. Mm-hmm. And then the house before that, when I was helping them move, there was a collection of these recipe cards, these Weight Watcher recipe cards that, my mom had been a Weight Watcher member, and you could, I guess, send away for these cards. And do you remember, like, this was like a 70s thing?
My aunt had the whole collection of them in, like, this yellow type of thing with a flip top.
Yeah.
That was it. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, and also, do you remember getting cards as a kid, too?
They were mailed them, like, once a month, right? Or something like that.
Like, the animals. The ones with the animals and stuff. Do you remember getting those? And
sounds familiar.
Like, yeah, I feel like the 70s, they were like cards. This is the next thing, you know, where they give you these, you know, sort of shrink wrapped, you know, things of cards that have information on them and then like a plastic case to put them in, and you were set.
Yeah, index cards were a big deal when I was a kid.
Yeah. So I came across some of these and I just started laughing. My mom's like, you know, I'm like, Mom, can I have these? And she's like, well, whatever, you know? and at the time I was, I had a blog, and this is so far back when, you know, when I started a blog, they weren't, they haven't even quite shortened it to blog. They were calling them web blogs.
Yeah.
And
it's like the days of Blogspot and stuff like that.
Well,
or no, GeoCities even.
Yeah. Well, actually what I was doing, I think I was like uploading the pages myself. Like you could,
oh wow.
Yeah. You didn't, you know, like they're like Blogger was like a Johnny come lately. And you know, you could do something, but just by like uploading, you know, the pages manually and then updating the index page and then the nav links and stuff. So, and then eventually like things like Blogger and like Diary X and, Live Journal and stuff like that.
I'm trying so many came and went, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And those were just scripts to, you know, to be able to do that stuff. And there were other funny websites that had vintage pictures of food. So this was, you know, there was definitely precedent. And so I think one day, I think it was actually on my birthday, I scanned the collection of maybe like 26 cards or something like that and put them up with captions.
Yeah.
And it went viral. and I mean, that wasn't a term used back then, but it was, that was a really weird thing because that was also in the day when image hosting was such a fraught thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to really, if you were going to have a website that had, you know, with like images of any kind, you had to like pay a lot more for things if a lot of people were going to be clicking on them.
Yeah, you wanted people to see it, but not too many.
Right. If you had, like, I had the basic, some sort of really basic like hosting package through, I don't even know, like it's called like homestead.com or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got so many visitors and it was the bandwidth of people clicking on these big image files and stuff was like too much. And they're like, oh, you've exceeded your limit. Cause they used to have limits on these things. And so I remember having to change, you know, hosting providers like in the middle of the night and re-upload things and stuff. And I remember even trying to like explain this to the people I worked with at my office who are all like my parents' age and, you know, weren't very computer savvy. And, you know, I couldn't even begin to explain to them what was happening, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like, well, why bother?
Yeah. Well, they were like, what are those people on the internet doing here? They're like, they're looking at my site. They're looking at pictures. They're like, why is that a bad thing? I'm like, it's not, but you know, so
It's turning into a second job.
Yeah. And so then I had these things up and it sort of helped me. It sort of led to my first book, which was this memoir called I'm at the New Me, which also had a sort of some pages in the middle that had pictures of the cards. And so
yeah, I noticed cover has a couple of pieces, like one called Frozen Cheese. Something.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I had been writing this blog and I had actually been sort of flirting with the idea of turning it into a book. And I had actually talked to some editors, you know, like about a year or two beforehand and, you know, nothing really ever came of it. So then when, you know, these cards kind of went viral and people started looking at them, I started hearing from like agents and editors who were like, hey, I've read your stuff. You know, do you have a book idea? And it just happened that I did. So that was, awesome. So that was how it started. And then, about a year after the first book came out, then there was sort of interest in like, hey, let's do a book with these cards too. And, it was also,
totally.
Yeah. Well, and also part of it too, it helped that Weight Watchers actually sort of officially wrote us and they're like, you know, sort of, they sort of said the sidelong way. They're like, hey, we're cool with this. We're not gonna sue or anything, you know. And they were pretty good about like not, you know, trying, you know, they recognize that this was old content and everything. And so the my publisher Riverhead was like, okay, so we have permission to use these cards, so let's, you know, to really use them, so let's do a book. So
that's really awesome of Weight Watchers to do that. I mean,
I know it was company. It was really cool. Yeah. So although we did not say in the book anywhere like Weight Watchers. So,
but still, you know, it's kind of good that, you know, you went with their blessings in a way where it's
right. Yeah.
You don't have to like wake up at 4 a.m. thinking, you know.
Yeah. So.
knock on the door. It's like right, a representative yeah, yeah. from Weight Watchers wants to talk to you outside. But, you know, so what else is, what's next for you? Because, you know, you're certainly a writer at heart. Mm-hmm. Do you have any projects that you're working on right now?
I'm working on an essay collection, and it's weird because I've been moving away a little bit from doing funny stuff, but, so it's, I don't know, I've been working on it for a while. Some of it is family history stuff. Mm-hmm. I inherited, again, you know, stuff I'm working on comes from stuff in my parents' basement.
Next book, My Parents' Basement.
inherited a big, just basically a big trunk full of dead ancestors. And I mean, not their, them physically, yeah. but like their pictures and their things. And there's actually some interesting people that on that side of the family. My great grandfather was a pulp, sci-fi writer.
Oh, and okay. Yeah.
Sort of in the golden age. And so he had sort of a short career, but like one of his, stories was made into a Twilight Zone episode.
Wow.
And he's actually sort of thought of as writing one of the first time loop stories. And, like every Groundhog Day I do, usually I have a Google search on his name.
What's
and
his name?
What his name will come up in some article on, you know, like Groundhog Day type stories. Cause he wrote one of the first ones.
And what was his name?
Malcolm Jameson.
Okay.
And then, you said you were into radio, right?
Early radio. Yeah.
Early radio. Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know the Aldrich family at all? They were like a sitcom.
You know, I'm listening to like The Shadow and The Whistler and stuff like that. So much the comedy stuff, but.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That was a sitcom. He might've done other stuff, but my great grandfather's brother, my great, great uncle was this guy, House Jameson. So he was a radio actor. And so he was the father in the Aldrich family. And he did lots of radio, although not a lot of it survives, but
that's pretty cool though to find this in your relatively recent family history.
There was also, it's funny because I came across this stuff and I sort of realized, I'm like, I know more about where the Ingalls family was in 1880 than where my own family was.
Yeah.
And so I think sort of going through that experience with the Wilder life and that sort of research and sort of following this this one family's chronicle really closely was sort of an interesting template for me to sort of like look be like, okay, well, what's the narrative here, what happened? And it's actually become like so much bigger than that, and it's become sort of more of a personal story too. And
did you know that you had writers in your family? Or was this something that came as a surprise?
I did. I was never really a sci-fi reader. So I wasn't, although my mother was.
And I think it's a different generation too,
And, so I did know that. And then, but it was, it felt really remote to me, but then, a few years ago, I'm like, wait, let me Google this guy. And like, Wikipedia entry. And, I'm like, oh, that's nuts. And, there's a Wikipedia entry about my great grandfather. And
that's so finding, awesome, though. I mean, that's really, really great. I mean, it's also just, I think it's also great that you would grow up to become, a writer, of course, in a different manner. You never know.
Yeah,
You can go right into sci-fi. Come on, Wendy.
Yeah, I mean, actually, well, I went back and read some of the stories, and I realized actually my mom had given me some of his stories to read when I was a kid, but I had read them and I'd forgotten that they were by him, and so there were things that I had always remembered. I'm like, oh wait, this story about this guy going backwards through time on a train, and so they always had been sort of with me. And not all of his stories, necessarily hold up, but and then some of you can sort of see how they're autobiographical, which is kind of neat. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this he had had cancer and he couldn't talk. And so he had this story about this robot who had like a worn out voice box and, you know, just things like that, you know, and sort of reading these things and the sort of then knowing his life and finding the connections in these, you know, these really kind of wild sci-fi stories to, you know, connections to like things in his own life.
Do you remember
and how he kind of worked them in? And that's kind of cool too.
Do you remember which Twilight Zone episode was based off of his writing?
Yeah, it's of late, I think, a Cliffordville or Cliffordsville. And I think it's one of the hour-long episodes, I think.
I just ordered the Twilight Zone Companion. I'm
okay.
I've always watched a Twilight Zone, but I'm kind of revisiting it right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought this book.
Yeah. This one has Julie Newmar in it as the devil.
Oh.
And, because this guy makes a deal with the devil and he goes back in time to, his old hometown. And because he wants to sort of like, you know, he's like a rich man and he wants to sort of like build his empire all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes back to a small town in Texas, which is funny because like in real life, my great grandfather grew up in Texas. And so like, you know, it's not the best episode, but it's still really fascinating. So
still Twilight Zone.
I mean, yeah, still, I know.
I think
yeah.
It's pretty darn impressive. But, so Wendy, I want to thank you so much for coming on here and talking to me about all of this.
Yeah.
Hopefully I can trick you into coming back on in the future.
Yeah.
So your website is wendymcclure.net.
Yeah.
I'll put a link to it in the show notes, as well as a link to your books and everything we kind of talked about.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, I really love your writing style. I do find it kind of just, I don't know. It's a very personal style. I really like it.
Oh, I'm glad you like the book. Yeah.
Like I really, I'll flip through and I'm like, oh, I got to do that. That I actually was taking notes as I'm reading it because you're talking about these long forgotten websites.
Yeah.
In here. Yeah. And I'm like, I never heard of that. And I look it up and it's not there anymore.
Oh, yeah. Well,
no, but you can still dig it up. I mean,
the book is 10 years old now this spring. So it came out, the hardcover came out in 2011. Mm. So I'm grateful that it's, you know, the hardcovers, I don't think it's probably hard to get find the hardcover now. I don't think it's in print, but the paperback is still in print. You can still get it new. So, unfortunately the Amazing Mackerel Pudding Plan is really hard to find now, because sometimes, and this is something I know from publishing, when things are printed in full color, the printing is really expensive. And so unless the book like takes off like hotcakes, sometimes they just do that one print run because it's, you know, if
it's
too expensive to reprint, do another print run if there isn't like huge demand. So
well, I'm going to be on the hunt for it. I love that kind of, I really love the whole retro thing. And I might even be on like garage sale in the summer looking for these Weight Watchers cards.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You can definitely find them. You know, if you want to buy a set from me, I've got some too. So I had to buy like extra sets, but
you should autograph them and sell them. You know, there's this YouTube channel, I forget the name, Emmy something, I forget what it is, but it's a really fun type of thing where this woman makes a lot of different kind of retro foods.
And
she went and made some of these like tuna gelatin molds,
mm-hmm.
but she doesn't do it in a goofy way. You know, some people don't go all out. She does in the proper way and, you know, makes it as proper as she possibly can. And it's fun. I don't know.
Yeah.
I see this, I think of a different universe.
I know. It's funny because I sort of have like a sort of a new respect too for like what people were trying to do, you know, with like the limited, you know, like ingredients that they had at, you know, I mean, in that
mackerel
era.
Pudding. And, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
God bless those people.
Yeah. And, you know, we're trying to sort of explore, you know, the foods of other cultures in their way when, you know, when there were things you just couldn't get. And, we can make fun of it now. But at the same time, you know, I think there's something really sweet about, you know, about these, you know, these recipes and, and, you know, the food stylists who were just trying their best.
Thank you for listening to the Little House Book Club. If you enjoy Little House on the Prairie and the history that surrounds it, you might want to take a listen to Wanna Grovecast as well as the Bonnetheads podcast. All of my podcasts are family friendly and listener supported.